Blog Talk Radio.
Coming up on the big show tonight, actress Patricia Clarkson and writer-director Ruba Nada will talk about their new film, Cairo Time, and we will return one of our favorite guests, actress Tana Frederick, coming up on Movie Geeks United. Hey, everybody, it's Movie Geeks United. I'm Jamie.
And I'm Jerry. And thank you. Well, I don't know. I didn't know whether you're going to introduce me or not.
So dramatic.
I know. We're so dramatic tonight. But no, I didn't know whether you're going to introduce me, and I was really hoping that you would pronounce my name the way you've been doing it for the last show or two, you know.
Jerry,
pile on acid kind of thing.
Yeah, I just realized. We will return actress Tana Frederick. What was I saying? We will welcome back one of our favorite guests, actress
Tana
Frederick.
Yeah, where are we returning her to? That was a great interview. I mean, every time we interview her, it gets better and better. I mean...
Yeah, it does. And you guys will be able to hear that a little later on in the show. How have you been doing? Have you seen any new flicks this past week?
I haven't seen anything since the last time we did the show and since the last time I spoke to you. I mean, I watched a lot of TV. I guess, all right, let's see. I watched True Blood. I watched Mad Men. And I watched last night, we watched Rescue Me, and I got caught up on Hung and Entourage. So that's all I've really been doing, you know, watching, getting caught up on TV. And if you have any questions about that, you can ask. I mean, but... That's all I've seen.
Nah.
Okay, I didn't think so.
What do you think of True Blood in Entourage this season?
I like True Blood, but I let out a factoid today at work that is going to not shock anyone, but I don't think I've ever been completely sober for an episode of True Blood. I've seen every episode. I'm just going to say I have been high-spirited during every episode.
Wow.
It makes it more enjoyable, I think. But
well, yeah, I suppose if
it is
a
good show. I actually do like the show, and I think it's gotten better. It's like the first season I was kind of iffy about. The second season, this season with the whole thing about the Nazi werewolves and everything, I'm just like, okay, this is really getting it's really getting a groove.
Yeah.
So I like it. So this season, I think the best so far.
You introduce Nazi werewolves in anything, and the show's bound
Nazis,
to find a groove.
Nazis in anything just makes it go up, in my estimation.
Yeah. I'm waiting for the Nazi werewolf subplot in Brothers and Sisters, I think,
that show could use it. That without a doubt.
And Entourage... Entourage is always kind of funny to me. It seems so slight
in a lot
of ways. I think the major appeal of it is you just want to spend time watching them hang out.
But I think it's kind of jumped the shark off and on, I would say, the last two seasons. I like it, though. People love to rag on it lately, but I like I'm kind of curious to see where this is all going to go this season, especially with Ari and the NFL and...
Yeah,
that's
what I'm saying about the show. It's not a show that I really. It never ends on a cliffhanger, really. I'm not anxious to see what happens. You just want to see them just exist together in Hollywood. And
I think that's actually the best thing I've ever heard said about the show. I think you're absolutely right because you're right. You know, every episode does wind. You know, ends. You know. There's some sort of closure. It ends very nicely. I think there have been some really top-notch seasons, though. This one I'm not sure about yet. But I enjoy it. I won't I won't lie to you. I try to watch it every week, so.
I just want to say thank you to a couple of listeners out there. One of our loyal listeners, Guy, he got bored at work the other day, apparently, and he mailed over a special banner that he photoshopped for us using
I
the Expendables.
I love that. Thank you, Guy.
Yeah, he's using the Expendables banner, and the faces of all the stars are replaced with you and I, Jerry, and Dean, who's a loyal caller of our show,
mm-hmm.
and all the major players that we discussed in last week's show, like Tom Cruise, Christian Bale, Mel Gibson, and Deborah Kerr.
I just love how we got Deborah Kerr in there. I just love
yeah.
that. I mean, I just think that's so funny. I mean, where else are you going to see all those people?
Wearing a nun's habit.
I know, that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope she's in the version of the Expendables I see. I really
yeah. And also, Turk 182. I know you're out there listening. It appears as though Turk 182 is going back through our catalog of past shows. I think he listened to like four or five of them today.
Mm-hmm.
God bless you.
Today?
Today, yeah.
That dude, Turk, you're awesome. Thank you.
Yes. Yes, thank you, Turk. And Turk 182, an obscure film reference, Timothy Hutton film.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember a thing about the film?
Yes, I do. I think when it came out at the video store, I ran out and got rented it.
Was he like a graffiti artist or something?
Wait, I think that's a good. Oh God.
Well, the poster is him leaning up against a brick wall, and in graffiti it says Turk 182, and I remember him like sitting on the ledge of a tall building at the end of it or something. It's very vague.
Hmm. Well, I'm trying to think. Maybe that needs to be remade, too. Well, look, Judge Roy Bean is in the chat room, and he says Falcon and the Snowman was great. So, okay, yeah, I like that. I like that movie a lot. Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
Yes.
I definitely love that movie.
Yeah, if they should make a sequel to it. It's Turk 183. I think that would be good.
Good. That's
that's the best I got tonight. Okay, there's a great new movie out coming out. It's called Cairo Time. It opens August 6th. I believe it opens limited in theaters, and it's available on IFC On Demand as well.
Supposedly, not to change too much the subject, but the Todd Solondz movie is going to be on demand too.
Yeah, it starts on demand Friday.
Yeah, I'm going to be staying at home a lot. All right, that's good. Okay.
Yeah, basically, essentially, people that watch Todd Solondz movies and enjoy them stay home a lot anyway.
I guess they do. You're right. Okay.
Anyway, Cairo Time. Cairo Time. Stars Patricia Clarkson in just another magnetic performance. It's a terrific movie.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it the other night, and it's really lovely. So if you guys get a chance to check it out, please do that.
The actor is a good actor, too. He's from Syriana, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
He's a wonderful actor. I like him a lot.
Yeah, he's terrific in the film, too.
Okay, cool.
Which brings us to our first guest tonight. Our first guest tonight is a goddess among actresses. She's
mm-hmm.
one of the most beloved and revered talents in films today, from her screen debut in Brian De Palma's The Untouchables, all the way to her stunning turns in Woody Allen's Vicky Cristina Barcelona and Whatever Works, and Scorsese's Shutter Island. Her new film is Cairo Time, and in the film she plays Juliet, a character who finds herself swept up in an unexpected romance against the backdrop of exotic Cairo. And we spoke to Patricia about the experience of shooting in Cairo and the arc of her character, and working alongside directors Woody Allen and Martin Scorsese. This interview was conducted by another one of the movie geeks, Aaron Adadiaz. So enjoy Patricia Clarkson. Here she is.
Reason for the visit?
I'm here to see my husband.
Miss Juliet, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, your husband has been delayed in Gaza. If there's anything you should need, please.
Oh, Mark, where are you? How long do you think? I can't say. Sorry, that long I'll go crazy. You know me. I'm going crazy. men keep following me. Why is everyone staring?
They're like beautiful women.
It's been years since young men.
I find that hard to believe. Why don't I take you to the pyramids?
Mark and I made a promise we'd see them together.
Of course.
I like your dress.
This isn't going to be a...
Oh.
Tomorrow, I will take the day off.
You can do that?
Of course.
Let's go.
Saw your film last night. Terrific film. Great performance, as usual. So,
oh, thank you.
I was curious. So how did you get involved with this material? How did this script come to you?
In just a conventional way. You know, I my agent called and said, you've been offered a movie. I'm sending you the script. I think it's a script you're going to really... like, and then he said, no, you're going to love it. I think you're going to love this, and I did. And Ruben Nada, the writer-director extraordinaire, flew to New York. We sat down for what was to be about a 45-minute cup of coffee, and it turned into a three-hour just extravaganza.
Right.
And next thing I knew, I was on a plane to Cairo.
And that was that sort of an appeal to you of film making a movie in Cairo?
No, I don't really. Yes. I mean, you know, the idea of going to this extraordinary exotic location, but it's not really why I would ever take a part or a film. I do. It is solely based on the script and the character, but it was a bonus. But I was a little frightened of going to Cairo as an American, and I was a little wary. But all of my fears were unfounded. It's not so much being an American in Cairo. You have to be a little wary of being just a Western woman in Cairo.
Right.
In certain areas, you have to be careful where you go, unchaperoned, without alone. But that's the exception, not the rule in this case.
And the thing about your character in the movie, you know, it's a very, her time there, it leaves a very visceral impact on her. It's kind of a, she's not going to ever forget her time in Cairo. So one has to assume that while maybe not as traumatic as her experience, but also there's some of that also with you when you left Cairo. Was there some of that with you also?
You mean some of that with me, Patty, when I left Cairo?
Yeah, you know, the experience of, you know, being there for, I think it was 25 days.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was life and art, and I was there for 7 weeks, so I really almost lived in Cairo for, I really did, and I truly experienced Cairo, and the good, the bad, and the ugly, and it's a breathtakingly beautiful city, but it has, you know, aching poverty and difficulty. And,
right.
But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. So.
And your character, Juliet, she goes through this kind of this very subtle transformation.
Subtle is the right word, yes.
And throughout the film. And I'm wondering, as an actress, what if that's more appealing of trying to modulate that kind of small transformation versus kind of a a major epiphany that, you know, that also happens in some characters.
No, it's one of the hardest journeys I've ever had to chart as an actor. And one that will stay with me forever. I think it made me a better actor, which is what you want to do. You know, you want to continue to grow as an actor, even if the ripe old age I am. You want to, and so it was very difficult because it's such an internal and such a personal, and she moved in half notes, and it was very difficult, but ultimately rewarding. It was so rewarding.
Right. Well, here's a kind of a silly actor question, and it's more about technique. But in this film, you have a lot of telephone scenes.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about...
telephone scenes. Oh, God.
And what is... telephone acting. What has been your relationship with that over the years? Have you gotten better at it, or is it always...
Yes, I mean, you hope. It's all still the same thing. It's still a scene, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a scene. And you have to really... It's still very... I mean, you can't view it any other way, or you're dead in the water.
Is it better to have someone on the line, or does it not matter?
You know, yes, it's always great to have someone on the line, but also, sometimes you can't, also because of sound and... sometimes it's very difficult. And so you have to actually really do your homework and know exactly what you're talking about and what you have to chart it out. You have to write it out. I really actually write it in my script, everything that I'm talking about, what the response is. Because sometimes I often was doing a lot of those scenes without anyone on the other end.
What's been the audience reaction to this film? It's been on the festival circuit. Now it's going
incredible. Wherever we've taken it, and you realize this film is played in Toronto, where it won Best Canadian.
Right.
It's in Doha, where it was so well received the first screening that they saved it for closing night. It went to Dublin. Then we went to Aruba. I mean, we've been to San Francisco. It's had such a beautiful response. I'm a little frightened. I'm thinking, oh my God, when's the shoe gonna drop? But who knows?
The last two questions I gotta ask. One, my favorite film of the year so far is Shutter Island. You're terrific in it. And so I'm wondering, that character is very pivotal to that story. You have one, you know, this major scene in it. So I was wondering, what could you tell me about that experience? Doing that, you know, working with Scorsese and doing that.
It's an actor's dream. You're working with one of the great directors of all time, and he doesn't disappoint. It was a beautiful experience. I was acting opposite Leonardo, and he again one of the great actors working today, and he doesn't disappoint either. So you have to be ready to rock and roll with Mark. You just do. You have to come ready to rock and roll. It's a very visceral, it's a very almost primal experience, and it's fun.
And finally, I want to ask you, you've worked with Woody Allen twice on back-to-back Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which is one of our other co-hosts consider that one of the best films of the decade, and also Whatever Works, which I consider a vastly underrated comedy by Woody Allen.
I do too. I think I love the movie so much, and I'm just so honored and thrilled to have been a part of it. Yeah.
Both of those are two very different types of Woody Allen films. One's broad comedy, one's a little more romantic and serious. And so I was just curious, is his approach to directing, was it any different on either film?
From what I gathered, no. You know, Woody's a singular experience. He has his vision, he has his way of working. I mean, he's just been doing it for so long now, and he's such a master.
Mm-hmm.
And he just knows how to do it. And I think he approaches you know, every story with the same set of, with the same parameters, with the same, I guess, insights, and whether it's a melancholy romance or a kind of bolder comedy, comedy of manners almost.
Right.
I think he comes out of the same way.
Well, before I let you go, what's coming up next for you? What do you have coming up?
I have, you know, this movie opens August, and then I have EZA coming up, this wonderful, funny comedy starring Emma Stone and Stanley Tucci, and I play her very kooky, eccentric parents. And then I have a film called Legendary. And Danny Glover and a wonderful young actor named Devin Gray. And that comes out both of those come out in September. So it's a wham bam, thank you, ma'am, next couple of months. I'm just like, I have to lie down when I think about it.
Okay, that's Patricia Clarkson. The movie is Cairo Time. It opens up August 6th. And Jerry, the actor that you were talking about that is her co-star in the film, that was also in Syriana, Alexander Siddig.
He's
very good.
Wonderful. He has a lot of charisma, a lot of wonderful screen presence. I'm really excited to see this film. So, yeah.
It's a good one. It's a really good one. And in just a moment or two, we'll play you the conversation I had with the director of the film. You think about Patricia Clarkson, Shutter Island from this year. She has just that one scene. It's such a great moment in the movie. It's terrific.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously the co-host that Aaron was referring to that with the Vicky Cristina Barcelona, that's me.
Yeah, I thought that was a given, but okay. I mean,
I was telling the people out there listening that might not know.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. All right, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the girl of the group that lost
to
Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
You and me
yeah.
can some days take a race in that one. But, yeah.
Okay. anyway, a beautiful actress, and we were honored to have her on the show. Let's talk now to Ruben Nada. Ruben Nada is an internationally acclaimed writer-director, and Cairo Time is her 17th film.
Wow.
And in many ways, it's one of the most meaningful and personal to her. And in this interview, she discusses the inspirations for Cairo Time and her choice of Patricia Clarkson as her lead actress, and the perils of shooting on location in Cairo. Here's Ruba. I'm curious what the initial inspirations were behind it.
There were a few. I'm Canadian. My parents are Arab. And on and off, we lived during my childhood in Syria, in Damascus, for about 4 years. And when I was 16, they took us for a visit to Cairo. And I just fell in love with the city. And so I pocketed that image, and I've been back to Egypt a couple of times now, and I just I'm sort of obsessed with how crazy it is, how chaotic it is, but also how ancient it feels, and just the history, and just how beautiful it is. And so I just pocketed that sort of feeling about Cairo, and then Juliet for some reason came to me a few years ago, and I saw her, you know, arrive to an international airport, and she's waiting for her husband, and then she gets set up, and so I ran with that idea, and then she gets picked up by a handsome man, and so
yeah.
I just combined those two ideas together.
The movie has a sense of place that very few movies I've ever seen have. I mean, it's very strong, and I'm wondering the experience of shooting in Cairo, because there doesn't look to be a real ability to control the crowds.
No, it was a nightmare. I really had to shoot in the city. I mean, you know, my producer was like, can't we shoot in Morocco? Can't we go somewhere else that's a little easier? And the problem is that once, just as a Westerner, when you enter that time zone, something happens to you. And so I had to capture that, you know, like I had to shoot in Cairo. we were battling an enormous amount against us. You know, the heat was unbearable. We were there from April to July. We were shooting June and July. You know, there's no sidewalks. There's no streetlights. It's so chaotic. There's 20 million people in the city. Mm. And so we had no control over our locations outside. We had to, you know, we can never shut it down and just, you know, have the like a cafe to ourselves. It just never happened. And so I'd have to let my actors loose, you know, in those locations and let them roll with it. But then mm-hmm. on top of all of this, we had a very strict censorship minder from the government who was watching our every single move. And it was a nightmare handling her and dealing with her and, you know, losing her when we needed to lose her. It was just, after the end of the movie, I thought my brain was going to go on a vacation because you just have to be on every single second while you're there.
Yeah. Yeah. And tell me about Patricia Clarkson, because she has such a natural grace and kind of luminescence about her. What made her perfect for this film?
Well, the thing is, I've been a huge fan of hers for years, and when I wrote the script, it was a very simple and subtle story, and it was, you know, it's Juliet never says exactly why she's unhappy or why she's sad or why she's feeling mm-hmm. out of sorts or in limbo in her life, and I really liked that. I felt that a lot of people can relate to that. And I knew that with Patricia, she can nail that feeling and that she can nail that sort of emotion on her face and trust that she doesn't have to go overboard or that she, you know, she can occupy that quiet, that space
yeah.
and be vulnerable and sort of be ordinary. And I knew that audiences would be with her, even though, you know, doing adultery, even though, you know, it's up for argument whether or not this movie is adulterous or not, it's still tricky. And so, you know, audiences sometimes get turned off by that. And
right.
And in this case, you know, everybody's just so with Juliet and Patricia that it's been fantastic.
And you get the sense that she, wherever she goes in life, she's going to take Kyra with her, that experience
yeah.
with her. Tell me about that journey. What journey does that character take?
Well, I mean, I think what I really wanted to do was I was feeling that in North America, romance and love and it was just everything. Like the way you spend a life, it's all about immediate gratification. You know, you want it now. You don't have time to wait. There's this lack of patience, and I really wanted to just tell this romance that was about. It was unexpected. It's unrequited, and there's restraint to it. You know that sometimes you don't get what you want in life. And so, and I don't want to give away the ending, but it's a great question what you've asked me, because what she does with Tarek is so much greater than, you know, physically consummating the relationship. Like what she does is like it's burned, it's engraved in her brain for the rest of her life, what she does with Tarek in the end. And I
yeah.
think that's way more meaningful than a physical kiss.
Well, yeah, and it is so not obvious or explicit, like you've said, you were trying to avoid being explicit about it, and you really do get the sense of that she is forever transformed at the end of the movie, you know, in a much different place at the end of the movie than she was at the beginning.
Yeah,
and you know, that's why I was curious from you where you think she is where. She didn't start there. Where did she end up?
Well, I mean, and that was really important in that I didn't, you know, I don't like the movies where, you know, you start off and then you leave your husband. You know, like I think for me as a character, I think what she realizes is, I mean, this is such a great question. I think emotionally what she realizes is she gets her marriage. She understands it. I think the last scene, I think what she's thinking is, you know, she has to basically suck it up and, you know,
right.
deal with it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But she's definitely thinking about Tarek.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, how could she not?
And the movie has such a great pace to it. It's a movie that takes its time to develop the atmosphere and the relationships. I'm wondering, was there a lot of tinkering in post? To try to get that tone and that pace just right?
We were really lucky. Not at all. It's the tone is so difficult for some reason, but I was trying to capture that atmosphere. It's like that Cairo atmosphere that I was trying to capture, and just something like, you know, the feeling between Tarek and Juliet. I keep saying this, but it's sort of that feeling that you have, you know, when you're in love with someone in high school. There's something like, it's like kind of hopeful and giddy, and for some reason you only feel that way in high school. It's like so pure and fresh and sweet and bittersweet and heartbreaking. And so I wanted to capture that. But it's hard, right? Like, you can't put it into words. Like, you can't, you know, you can't physically build a scene around that feeling that I just described. And so we either captured it on the day or we didn't. And so editing was actually quite easy. We just had to really trust ourselves to keep the pacing as it was and have patience and keep it restrained and not get, you know, taken over by, you know, wanting to cut it like a music video.
Well, and plus the atmosphere, the crowds, and it's hectic. I mean, it's a hectic environment, but, you know, borderlining on chaos. And the two of them together, it's like a calm in the middle of the storm.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, thank you so much for saying that, because the thing about Cairo is that it's so chaotic. It's so nuts. It's so fast. It's so crazy. But the people are so calm.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that I had to get that, you know? Like, I knew that if my cinematography was, like, crazy and frenetic and hectic, that I would miss the point,
mm-hmm.
you know, because something – Cairo forces you to let your guard down, and it forces you to slow down whether you want to or not. And you get used to that feeling very quickly, actually. You know, the thing is, your phone breaks down, you can't fix it, what are you going to do? You know, and you know, you're rushing to get to a meeting, and someone's half an hour late in Cairo. It's like, but everybody takes it with such a calmness. You know, this is life, and you kind of... You know, after 3 months, it was very difficult for us to come back to North America. We got so used to it. We got so used to, oh, it's okay. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. Now you've played a lot of festivals with your films, and I'm assuming you played quite a few festivals with Cairo Time.
Yes.
What is that experience like? What does that give you as a filmmaker? That kind of feedback.
Vindication. You know, when it premiered at TIFF, Toronto Film Festival, and then it's gone on to premiere at all these festivals, I'd had a lot of pressure to alter the script, to make Juliet in her 20s rather than in her late 40s. I had a lot of pressure to just have a sex scene. I had, you know, you get a lot of pressure as a filmmaker, and I was stubborn, and I just stuck to this gut, very strong feeling that I had in my gut,
mm-hmm.
and you know, seeing and it's always the same reaction, no matter if it premieres in Toronto Film Festival or if we take it to Aruba Film Festival, it's the same reaction we get from the audience. And to me, that's vindication, because, you know, I think audiences are a lot smarter than we give them credit for, and they know when something's authentic, and they know when something feels human. And wherever I take this movie, people have that same reaction, and it's because, you know, I loved the movie so much, and I love the story so much, and I love these characters so much, and I get giddy with excitement when people connect.
Yeah.
I really do.
Can you ever, since you live with it for so long, is this the period where you kind of have to let it go almost?
Yeah.
Is that difficult?
Yes, because, you know, I was at a screening yesterday during the day. And it's just, I hear the music, I know exactly what part we are in the movie, and my heart drops. And it's like that kind of sick feeling I have at the pit of my stomach, like, it's love. I love this. It's like my baby. But I know, you know, and this is something I do as a filmmaker, like, you make the movie, you throw it out there, it either sticks to the wall or it doesn't. And there's not much you can do except, you know, try to support as much as you can.
Yeah.
But I think the U.S. premiere is my closure. For the movie,
mm-hmm.
and I have to move on. But it'll all, like, it's my sweetheart. You know, it's always like a pit in my stomach.
Yeah.
But I
yeah.
like that. I love that, you know. Like, I think if I didn't have that, then I would be a sellout. I would have sold out for something, and I don't think that's cool.
Well, it means something to you, and
yeah.
it should.
It should, yeah.
Yeah.
It's meaningful.
Well, okay, that's Ruben Nada, writer-director of Cairo Time, starring Patricia Clarkson. So go see it. It opens August 6th. And it's an IFC. It's an IFC film, and I don't have specifics on this, but don't they release everything they do on demand?
Not everything. I thought they would do that they might have done it with Antichrist in some parts of the country. They never did it around here on Comcast. Never.
They did it on my part of the country. So if you live in my part of the country, if you live in Florida, you could see a movie like Antichrist. All right, Dean. Get to the point.
Inception. Of course, you know that I'm not a huge Chris Nolan fan, and particularly not of The Dark Knight. So I was going in with very low expectations, and I have to say, the movie is a work of genius.
Wow! I
really, really thought that its logic was airtight.
Mm-hmm.
Its dialogue was good. See, everybody was talking about how it was all like expositional and everything. Or the people who were talking negatively about it were talking about how it was expositional dialogue. And I was thinking it was going to be people in a room, you know, recounting, you know, the rules of the game or whatever. And I didn't get that at all. I felt it was all very visually transmitted. All of it was very necessary information, not only to get the where and the why of the movie's action, but also to understand the emotions behind it. And that's another thing. It's a movie that's also been considered by some to be a cold movie, and I thought that it was just rife with emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that it was by far his most emotional movie, and
I actually think a lot of his movies are very emotional. I mean, don't take this. I actually think I know you're not a fan of the two Batman movies, but I find the Batman movies to be very emotional too. But I actually think Inception, especially once we get deeper and deeper into his story,
yes,
it's. I'm sorry, the scenes with Marion Cotillard are just, wow, whoa. I mean, you can't help but get wrapped up in it. I mean, if you're paying attention, you really can't. I mean, the whole thing and especially the last 5 minutes, I think the last 10 minutes of the film, when they wake up, when everyone wakes up, your heart's pounding. I don't care who you are, if you've been paying attention, your heart is racing to see how this ends.
It's quite a movie in terms of it's weird because when I got out of it, I knew it was a great movie because I had that walking on a cloud feeling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you have that after All the Right Moves?
No,
I'm sorry, Top Gun.
I didn't. No, definitely not. I gave Top Gun a bad review, even though I got.
I know.
Full thing.
Yeah.
But the movie not only made me feel like I was walking on a cloud. See, I'm a musician too, so there's a certain feeling that I have after I've practiced music, and I feel like I've exercised part of the brain that doesn't normally get it, you know, get that kind of exercise. And I felt that kind of buzz in that part of my brain after watching Inception. I kind of felt it's because music is sort of it's mathematical, and especially if you're a drummer like I am. So it's like I felt sort of a mathematical kind of buzz going on in my head. And I can't remember a movie that's ever done that to me before. So it just fired on everything was right about it. I mean, everything was right about it. The only niggling little detail that I might have is that, and this is just a little thing that I've gotten since I watched Lost for seven seasons or however many, six seasons. I don't like it when characters use the two words, I need. I need you to do this. I need you to do that. Just tell people to do that. Don't tell me you need them to do it. It's something that they did on Lost all the time, you know. I need you to go across to the other side of the island and press this button. Or,
I need your help
on this. You know, that kind of thing. And I felt like they did a little bit of that too much in Inception, but that's just a little pet peeve
of
mine.
There was one scene that reminded me of Lost. I don't know if it's related to what you're talking about or not, but it's one scene, just visually, that reminded me of Lost, and that's when they all start, when he's the last one to wake up in the plane.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of, I don't know what, there's something about the way that it's the shot is framed.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me of, like, the way you're, a really good episode of Lost would end, you know, and it reminded me, that was the first thing I thought of during that part of the film.
Of course, there's, you know, when on a plane, it's like shooting in a car, you know, there's a limited number of setups.
Right, but this is the way it was, it just seemed, it had that feel, like in the way Zimmer's score starts again, you're like, wow. It looks familiar, but in a good way, and I mean that as in a compliment to both Nolan and the creators of The Lost. It was just really interesting. Also, I just say that because, you know, we just got done with, as you said, 6 seasons of Lost, so.
I wouldn't know. I need to see it again.
A comedian.
Hey, listen, the score was really great. I thought that's Hans Zimmer's best work by far. I thought it was very... extremely diverse kind of score, even right down to the sort of James Bondy music cue when the snow comes in. And
I have it on in the background, actually.
Did you know that the score, have you seen that thing on YouTube that where the guy analyzes the score for a minute?
I heard about it. I haven't actually watched it. I know what you're talking about, but I actually haven't sat down to watch it, though.
It's very interesting. Just look, I don't know what it's called on YouTube, but, well, I'll just sort of explain it and you can look for it yourself. But basically what it is Hans Zimmer's score, that piece of, you know, insistent music that you hear going over and over again, like almost like a sort of a drum beat or a foghorn or whatever. That piece of music is actually the piece of... Edith Piaf's song that they used to wake up, it's that piece of music slowed down.
I thought that was a cute touch. I thought that was a nice, like, little in-joke to her casting in the film.
Right, but it's actually
I thought that was
awesome.
So funny. I actually was laughing during that.
It was funny. But it's that piece of music that they used to wake up, only slowed down incredibly, which also relates back to the slowing down of time in the movie and so forth. So it's like, there's just a lot of stuff there to go back in mind for many years to come, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Well, I'm delighted and I'm delighted by your unexpected reaction to Inception. Dean, I'm trying to figure you out. Every time you call in, we get a new morsel of information about you.
Well, isn't that good? Isn't it the best kind of person to be? One that we learn something new about?
You are you're a musician.
Yes.
You have a trust, and you like to talk a lot. So I'm wondering, are you that guy from Shine?
I wish. I'd be nice. I'd be married and have plenty of money and be all talented and everything.
That would be very nice. Yes, I hear you.
And I'd be just as crazy as I am now.
There's nothing wrong with being crazy.
Yeah, I'm right on the edge, man. But, I'm an artist. I draw and paint and all sorts of crazy stuff. And,
God
but anyway,
bless you.
Kids Are All Right. I watched that. I loved it.
Yeah, it's an incredible film.
It is. You think that Mark Ruffalo's a bad guy in that movie?
Well, I don't want to give too much away because, I mean, I don't think he's a bad guy. I like where his character goes, but I think in the eyes of his kids, maybe, especially the daughter, he's, I like how, what I like about her movies is that they're hyper-realistic. I mean, she never throws you, like, a false note, whether it's Laurel Canyon or High Art. I mean, she's
yes.
a really underrated filmmaker. People don't give her her due, but, I mean, I like the directions that, that went in. The movie has a lot going for it. I hope, you know, maybe it does more than any anti, any political campaign against Proposition 8 could ever do. It does in 2 minutes more what any political campaign can do. I mean, what she's done
and without getting on the stump or anything.
She's created the perfect American family film for the 21st century.
I think it really is.
That's what it is.
There goes that same guy. He always uses his sirens to go through the red light. Yeah, so I thought it was a very, very complex movie. I didn't feel that it ever played favorites. I really empathized with where everybody in it was coming from, and felt that everybody was kind of not a victim of circumstance, but just, you know, caught up in something that they weren't expecting to happen.
Yeah, I also think Julianne Moore's speech that she gives about marriage being hard work is utterly brilliant. That thing that she gives towards the end is just astounding. And the best work I think she's done since when she breaks down in Magnolia, personally.
I agree completely. And to tell you the truth, I felt like it was her performance that, I mean, out of a really great cast that everybody was working top notch, but I felt that she just eked out just a little bit in front because of, you know, certain laughs that she got. Like when she first gets out of the truck in her outfit to go and work for the first time, there was something about that was funny. And there was, the way she says, for instance, thank you at the end of that speech that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
The way she says thank you is something I've never heard, you know. It was just sort of a pained, kind of embarrassed kind of thank you. It was really something extraordinary, and I know everybody's talking about Annette Bening as the sort of sentimental favorite to get nominated for the Oscar, and of course. But I don't hear that much about Julianne Moore, and if I do, she's somehow put in supporting category, which I
have a feeling you're right. They do love it. Well, let's put it like this. If Annette Bening is nominated, that must mean Hilary Swank has a role coming out. And
and Hilary Swank will steal it from her, right?
Yeah, I know. So,
but it doesn't look like Conviction's going to do that. So, that's right.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Yes.
Yeah, Conviction doesn't look to be that movie. It might be Sam Rockwell's movie, though. I saw Winter's Bone.
That's a wonderful movie.
You did. I'm a Southerner, and I have a beef about Southern depictions of Southern people made by people who I suspect are not Southern, and I suspect that director is not Southern.
But let me ask you this, though. All right, let me. Uh-huh. Having said that, she's made two movies now, this and Down to the Bone.
Right, which I also thought was similarly flawed.
It's similarly flawed, but it does show you there's two things I like about the movie. The first one being that in a not-so-overt way, the damage that drugs do, is to everyone involved is astounding. I think
that's true.
What she shows in those two movies, the extent of drug use and just the collateral damage, if you will,
right,
of drugs is astounding. I think her depiction of the South is not a stereotypical. Let me put it to you like this. She's like David, in that regard, this director, and I don't know her name off the top of my head, you'll forgive me, but it's very much like David Gordon Green. They are not condescending, typical Hollywood portrayals of the South.
Okay, but let me stop you there. Okay, now, I would agree with you on David Gordon Green because David Gordon Green is from North Carolina.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's fine with David Gordon Green. I think he gets the South right.
Right.
However, I'm not quite sure where Deborah Granick is from, but I don't think she's from the South.
Okay, but isn't this Appalachia?
Well,
though?
It's true, but that does reach down into the South.
Okay,
so.
Okay, all right.
So let me ask you this, Dean.
Okay.
If I can chime in here for a second.
Sure.
So when Norman Jewison was going to make Malcolm X, and Spike Lee kind of took it from him and said, a person of color needs to make the story of Malcolm X. Do you agree with that argument?
Yes.
Okay.
I do. I think that that's, I'm not talking about Malcolm X here. I'm talking about the Southern thing. See, I don't believe that there are that many Southern filmmakers working on movies about the South at all.
Right.
In fact, I don't think that a Southern filmmaker could get a movie done about the South. Hold on. That was a cop. Yeah, see, that was a Yankee cop coming after me. I don't think that a Southern – I don't even know of any Southern filmmakers that are working, other than if you want to count Victor Nunez, who works in Florida.
Right.
And the part of Florida that could be considered the South, like Yulee's Gold or whatever.
Right. Oh, it's a wonderful forgotten film.
Yeah, it is. He's done a lot of great forgotten movies. That's the only Southern filmmaker that I can say. Oh, and David Gordon Green. David Gordon Green is the new one.
But he's moved on to mainstream comedies, though, I think. So I don't know if he's ever going to go back. Not that that's a bad thing, but I don't know if he's ever going to go back to, like, All the Real Girls or Undertow. So I don't
see
that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I'll be very disappointed if he doesn't do that. I mean, you know, if he doesn't use some of the collateral that he's got to go back.
I tell you what, as an actor, Robert Duvall has given terrific prominence to genuine Southern characters.
Well,
this
even
is true.
Jack Grant is the director of The Apostle. I mean, that.
Yeah.
And we would have to give it to Billy Bob Thornton too. Not only for Sling Blade,
Daddy
but also for Daddy and Them. Which I thought was extremely realistic. So yes, there are a few, and I agree with Robert Duvall too. Particularly, of course, with The Apostle. So there are a few, but there need to be more. It needs to be, I mean, it is a quarter of the country, and I don't think that there's nearly enough.
What about a movie that came out right before the end of 2002, or at least I saw at the end of it, called Tully? Did you ever see that?
I haven't seen that.
That's along the same lines as All the Real Girls, story-wise. Let me just look it up real quick. It's a great little movie. It came out actually 2000. And Hilary Birmingham. God, we have all these great female directors, and we never make a big deal about them unless they're Nancy Meyers and Nora Ephron, which is a real tragedy. I'm just trying. Let me see where the shooting location is, though. But I'm pretty sure it's the South.
Well, there's another guy too named Julius Goldenberger, I think, who did a couple of movies, I think, that are both set down in the South. Well, I know the first one is. It's about a teenage runaway, and it's called Trans, and it's set in like northern Florida. And then he did a movie with Paul Giamatti the name escapes me, but
The Hawk is Dying.
The Hawk is Dying, right.
That was shot in Gainesville or Tallahassee or something.
There you go. He's another Florida filmmaker. That's an interesting voice that doesn't really get out there very much and probably has trouble getting financing. But
no, it's all got the financing. If it's not financing, then it's distribution. I mean,
yeah. But that said, okay, now I'm not slamming on Winter's Bone completely, because I did think that it was filled with great atmosphere, and of course the lead performance is superb, and I thought that a lot of the photography and, you know, the sort of seedy art direction was good. But I also felt like the plotting and the dialogue felt like the screenwriters had gone to the mill a couple of times too many.
Okay,
and
let me ask you this, though, about the lead performance, because I actually think the lead performance I would put in the front runner for Best Actress just because the weight of her problems and in the world are on her shoulders, and you just think this girl is going to break, like her spine is just going to collapse with everything that she's been handed to her. Because if you had to ask me what the best performance of last year was, it was Katie Jarvis in Fish Tank. And this movie reminded me a lot of that performance. Fish Tank's a British movie.
Right, I haven't seen it yet.
And I would have given her Best Actress hands down over anyone that was nominated.
Mm-hmm.
I really would have. I mean, she had never acted before. I mean, she was not even, trained to be an actress, but it was just incredible. But I just really felt the weight of the world was on her, and you could tell. I mean, you just like think that this girl did not want to get up in the morning, and that she did, more power to her, because she was just getting the worst deck handed to her every hour.
Well, she did have the weight of the world on her. She just happened to have an iron spine. That's the thing. She had like you said, she had been bred and buttered in that family, and that family was tenacious about.
That's a kind word for it. Yeah.
And who was the first person among us to rave about that actress, Jennifer Lawrence?
Was that you, Jenny?
It was me.
It was.
We've had her on the show for. I didn't see Winter's Bone. I saw The Burning Plain. We had her on for that film.
But okay, so what was the question? She's terrific. I mean, come on, she's outstanding. And it is one of the performances of the year. So, and it's definitely one of the debuts of the year, although it's not really a debut, but it's a breakthrough.
It is a breakthrough.
I would put it in the running with Greta Gerwig in there for the running for that for Greenberg. But
I would too.
She was actually talking. She was talking. She did a movie that Tank Girl, Lori Petty directed. Jennifer Lawrence did that. She was really excited about.
Yeah. Lori Petty did direct a movie recently.
And what happened to that? Where's that?
I don't know. She didn't know what was happening to it, but she was anxious to see how it came together.
Okay. And then finally, this will be really quick. I saw Salt tonight, and I didn't. First of all, of course, it's all about Angelina Jolie. She sells it all. Anytime she's not on the screen, is time kind of wasted. I felt that the first act really didn't work all that well, even on an action level.
Mm-hmm.
But then I felt when it came to the second and third act, particularly when it came to the second act, I felt that it had graduated into another area of action movie in which it was all the action was meant to be funny. You know, I just thought it just went over the top into a funny thing. You know, before, in the first act, I was saying, whatever happened to the people like John McClane, who actually got bled when he walked on, you know, glass and stuff like that, and in the Die Hard movies, and then it got into that second act, and I was like, all right, well, now I'm just going to have fun. And plus, I just thought that the movie was plotted better.
It's a movie that from the I think is an awful trailer for the movie, because I couldn't say, but it's actually watching it unfold. It's actually. You can't help but get wrapped up in it. No, I agree with you. The first 20 minutes is like, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets better. You're absolutely right, and I think that's the thing. It just gets, and it's so outlandish. I mean, it just becomes more and more outrageous with every scene.
And she has, she definitely has grace. Although I do believe also that the movie does. Although it does it better than some, but I do believe that the movie does do that sort of action directing where you can't really tell who's being hit kind of thing. But it was okay. It was fine.
Yeah. It was better than I thought it would be. Let me put it to you that way. I didn't think it would be anything when I first heard about it, and I was really pleasantly surprised.
A lot better. Yeah, a lot better. A lot better.
All right, Dean, we're going to get to our final interview before we close the show out.
All right, just thought I'd give you an update. I haven't
talked
about the movie.
Oh, you're great. That was great. You made my life a lot easier. Thank you. No, I
all
mean
right,
that in a good way, because we got to talk about movies that I saw a while ago, so I really appreciate that. So thank you.
Yeah, it's good to talk about them a little bit later, too. So one more thing. So you're going to do, like, trivia thing one night?
Yeah, it looks like you're the guest of honor. So.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, I'll take all comers and see what happens.
All of us will be involved in it, but yeah, it'll be next Wednesday night.
Yeah.
Are we going to keep score?
Oh, geez.
Oh, God, you're making this really more official than it should be.
I'll keep score. Come on.
Score. Okay, all right, you can do that. I hope the cops don't come again for you, but I mean.
Yeah, well, we won't place any bets, and it'll be all right. So great show, and I'll talk to you a little bit later.
All right, thanks, man.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye now.
Bye, guys.
Okay, let's get to our final interview. A favorite guest of ours, actress Tana Frederick. You can see her in Henry Jaglom's Irene in Time and Hollywood Dreams and upcoming in Queen of the Lot. And she's also just finished the fourth year of the film festival she founded. It's called the Iowa Independent Film Festival, and she's currently on stage in L.A. in a play written by Mr. Jaglom. And in this conversation, we catch up with her about all of that and a lot more, and we even play a little trivia with her. So here's Tana Frederick. We love you on the show. You've been on a couple of times, and you're
time.
One of our
is
favorites.
The third time?
Yeah.
I think it is my third time. Oh, that's so nice of you guys.
But it feels like the first time, doesn't it?
Yeah. It always feels like the first time with you, gentlemen.
Right. So tell me about you. You just completed the fourth year of your film festival.
Yes, it was so great. I can't believe we went 4 years, and I mean we're going strong, and had a great turnout this year. Mark Wydell, who directed On Golden Pond, The Rose,
mm-hmm.
For the Boys, he got the Lifetime Achievement Award, and we had some really cool rough cut screenings as well, which I'm kind of thinking of going in that direction next year for the Iowa Film Festival, because what's really neat is that people from Los Angeles who have now heard about the Iowa Film Festival look forward to going out there, and because, you know, of course I'm an Iowa file, and I'm biased because I love all Iowans, but they really do have intelligent, kind of unbiased things to say about the films that they see, and they'll be very honest and critical, and you know where it needs to be, and so these people, filmmakers, are really enjoying bringing their films to Clear Lake, Iowa, and to having them shown and getting feedback, and including that in their process of finishing completing their films. So we had Charlie Matthau there this year, Walter Matthau's son, and he is an amazing director, and he brought Baby-O with Teresa Russell, and but it was just a rough cut with Teresa Russell and David Proval. So he got some really great feedback as far as where to take the film. And then also Zach Norman came in with a film, Overnight, and he did the same thing. It was a Q&A. It was a rough cut, and they really appreciate, you know, having the Iowan audiences to tell them, you know, where they think they should take the film. And so I'm kind of thinking of next year incorporating, you know, this aspect of having a film festival where you can show rough cuts, where we welcome rough cuts. And I don't think it's done very much around the country, but
it isn't done.
Kind of
this is a really good idea, because a lot of people, I mean, definitely take it to the source, take it to the audience, and have their feedback, because you need that. It's better than
exactly.
It was wrapped up. I mean, at least you can go back and tweak it, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, the caucuses are held there first, you know,
mm-hmm.
So why not bring your movie there to show it there first
right.
Before anywhere else?
Yeah.
You know, it's the pulse of the country.
But is there
access,
a,
you know.
Is Well, it's the Heartland.
Right. It's like you have the Iowa's Writers Workshop. I mean, they really are. They know what's going on there. So, I mean, it's a good. That's a good. I think it's a good strategy with the films. I think that's great.
Cool. Thanks for that. Because yeah, I'm thinking about it.
Did you find though that there a preconceived notion about Iowans and how they would respond to film before the filmmakers get there?
Of course. They're, I mean, it's, you know, they have definitely a Norman Rockwell idea of the, you know, of what the festival is going to be like and if it's okay to say the F word in the movie, you know, when in fact, for example, this year, Julie Davis brought her film called Finding Bliss, which was just released here in Los Angeles and New York, and it's this great film about Julie's experience when Julie graduated from NYU with honors and, you know, directing. She moved out to L.A., and the only job that she could get was editing porn for Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she told her sweet, wonderful parents, you would never believe that. I mean, it's a hilarious premise. That she was working for Spielberg and editing for Spielberg. And so this whole movie that she made is based on her experiences, you know, trying to make, to sneak a film in at night and make, you know, use a Playboy facilities to create her own independent film. And it's a genius film with Jamie Kennedy and Lily Sobieski and Denise Richards. And so, you know, Julie was really nervous about what the audiences would think, but man, the Iowans ate it right up. I mean, it's kind of like what I say about Iowa is Iowa is like it's like the Catholic school state of the nation. You know, you think that we're going to be all pious and clean cut and squeaky, you know, but actually we're a little bit, you know, darker and dirtier than you think.
And I've seen Finding Bliss. It is a really good entertaining movie. Yeah.
Yeah, isn't it a great film? Julie is really. I'm running. Julie plays my sister in it. We've been running a play out here in Los Angeles for a year now, which is amazing for LA, considering, you know, most plays close after 3 days and they're just showcases for TV, you know, for TV casting directors. But she's a great girl, and I really loved her prior films, Amy Zoe, and she just has this great body of work. I really look up to her a lot.
Yeah, it is a great movie. So tell me, now you're doing the play, and that's extended throughout August, is it?
Now until September 19th.
Oh, wow, good.
And then, yeah, and then we quit the day after we finish and we wrap the play, we start shooting it as a film.
Oh, you're going to shoot it, okay.
Yeah, because we've gotten such a great response from it, and it's going to be kind of weird. I mean, Henry, you know, doesn't usually have such a consolidated script.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that all of the actors have been doing the same, you know, however, 200-plus shows of this play and then turning it into a movie, I think it's going to be really fun. It's going to be kind of weird and exciting because, I mean, I've never done that, taken something that's so, you know, entrenched in my brain and my body and then, like, tried to, you know, put that onto film. I don't know how it's going to be, but hopefully it won't be stale. Hopefully it'll be fresh and exciting and I don't know. It's going to be great, I think.
Well, I think it sounds like maybe the experience of it, too, might be bittersweet because you've been living with it for a year and then you do the film and then the film is, you know, your process of kind of saying goodbye to it. You know?
Oh, God.
I don't want to bring you down.
How did you say that?
Yeah, really.
I didn't even think about it like that until now. Oh, my God. It's going to be like this Death March. No.
I didn't mean that necessarily. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just kidding. No, it will be sad. It'll be sad, but it will be fun. It'll be a nice send off. You're right.
Yeah. And tell me when you're doing a show like that, over 200 performances, how do you keep it from getting stale? Are you constantly discovering new things?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I think the thing that I've learned, because I've never run a show this long, but of course it's been a dream of mine to do that. And, you know, I think the thing that I realized through this show is any ounce of perfectionism that I place on myself, you know, regarding performances or being correct or, you know, acting correctly or, you know, any idea that I had of being good or bad completely is wiped off the slate. You know, it's kind of like you just come to the show with what you have in you that day, and then you use that. And so it's been very relaxing and enjoyable to sort of you just sort of lounge into the character versus like pushing and trying to be the same every night. You just give that up because there's no way, you know, you're exhausted. There's no way you can do the same performance every night. So, and plus it would be boring as hell to do that, you know? So you just try to find, new ways to go about things. And the family is, the actors in it are fantastic. And so we're always finding new things to do and playing practical jokes on each other and stuff like that. We're all
kind
of amateur rats, I don't know.
Do you find, too, that it's kind of when you're doing theater, obviously it's live, but each performance is like a living thing, and the audience dictates a lot of how that show will be that night?
Oh, completely. That's the one thing. That's a really good question. That's the one thing that kind of terrifies me now because I never realized how much the audience does have control over what kind of a performance you give, you know. And of course, in the ideal state, you would say, oh, it's, you know, it doesn't matter. The audience doesn't count. It's all about what you do for yourself. But that's a lot of BS, man. I mean, if the audience is laughing, you're going to do a great, I mean, this is a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If they're laughing, it's going to be a better show. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about that, you know. And like, for example, this weekend, we had no laughs. Dead silence on Friday and Saturday night. And then last night, this huge roaring audience, you know, a whole bunch of African Americans like in the audience going, mm-hmm, oh, that's not kosher. You know, it's like just making this great commentary, just really. And of course, our show went fantastic and we got a huge standing ovation. I mean, it does feed the actors. It feeds our energy if the audience is participating and not falling asleep in the front row. I wish it weren't like that, but it is.
Well, you never know. You know, I love live theater stories. And this is funny. I heard something that Pacino said about when he was doing a play and he felt these eyes on him from the audience. And he found himself acting to those eyes the entire play. And he felt like he gave the greatest performance of his life. And then the lights come up, and he finds out that it was a seeing eye dog in the front row. So he was playing to a dog the entire show.
Oh, that's great.
That is a great story.
Oh, my God, that's great.
Let me ask you this, though. Does it break? How does when it's supposed to be funny and the audience doesn't laugh, how jarring is that to you and the other actors? I mean, you're not getting, I know it shouldn't be, but it must be inside. You must be
going nuts. No, it is. Yeah, it really is. Because these are very obviously funny lines. Well, the thing is, and that's a great question, too, with this play, and you'll eventually see it as a movie, it's the sort of the age-old conflict between civilians versus show folk, right? So it's kind of a new, you can't take it with you type story. And so you find that the houses that you have that aren't show folk really don't get the first act. And then now we've kind of prepared ourselves to, okay, you know, they're not laughing at the first act, but by the second act, you know, they're going to get into it because it's more emotional. It's more, it's not so theater oriented with all, you know, the content. But man, I mean, we sometimes play jokes on each other and like we'll sit in back. Zach Heller, for example, is this brilliant studio actor, and he plays the patriarch of the family. And every day he comes back after the show, and if the audience isn't laughing, he'll just start ranting. And so one of the other actors took his cell phone and started like filming this succession of Jack coming out and saying, "What are they all dead out there? What's going on?" This is, you know. And so we have this, like, great succession of Jack just being angry, but I mean, it sounds better than it does when I'm telling you this. It's much funnier if you were to see it, of course. But yeah, it's really interesting how it varies so much and how much it does affect the performance. And so, and also, you know, there'll be nights where nobody laughs and you think they're asleep and then they give you a standing ovation. I mean, it's just, the more I do this show, the more I realize I know nothing about theater. Because I'm constantly being dumbfounded by the reactions that I'm getting from the audiences.
But that's what's exciting about it. I mean, you're constantly, new. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
And aren't Henry's movies kind of the closest you can get in the movie world to a theater experience, because he allows the accidents to happen and they're not so tightly controlled and wound?
Well, that's the conundrum about working with Henry, is that when you work on a film with him, he has the structure, and then you do the scene, and then he lets you just parlay off onto your own dialogue and take the scene wherever you want to go, right? So you know you're pretty safe, because, I mean, he had Tuesday Weld and Jack Nicholson, you know, in a safe place. They kind of set the precedent for that by, you know, because Henry said they are going to come up with much better dialogue than I'll ever come up with. And so as a result, for the rest of his films, he kind of just lets the actors go off into their own, you know, as long as they have the plot points and the essentials of the scene, they can kind of essentially say what they want. But Henry, as a playwright, sits in the audience, comes to nearly every show, mm-hmm. and literally you see his black hat back there and his crossed legs, and you see him with a pad of paper making notes the entire time. Then he comes backstage and he says, well, you said A, and it was supposed to be the. And
wow.
You know, and oh, yeah, complete psychotic.
That's like Mammoth.
Hitler.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's no room for, I mean, if actors even do the slightest little cheat on one of his lines, he's infuriated. And I know he doesn't mind me telling this because he laughs at it himself, but, you know, you definitely do not want to catch the wrath of Henry if you flub one little line. And you know, these are dialogue-heavy scenes and monologues and lines. Henry's, you know, very talky, so
yeah.
There's a lot of stuff to try to remember and get right. And so, no, I would say it doesn't necessarily – his theater style doesn't necessarily lend itself to kind of flying by the seat of your pants. It's very structured.
Well, with working with such a great director like Henry and spotlighting great directors in your festival – do you think you're going to get that directing bug yourself sometime soon?
No way. No way. A snowball's chance in hell. I hate directing. I hate it. I tried it. I took a course at the University of Iowa and tried directing. And I think, you know, I remember doing this project and I had this great concept. It was for the Glass Menagerie. And I thought, oh, how about we put the two lead characters in, you know, they're in a boxing ring. And so they're actually, like, boxing out this, you know, the entire scene, this very gentle scene between them. And I got an F on it, and I was just like, okay.
Wow.
I don't think so.
Well, on the plus side,
I
think you would be a great Laura in the Glass Menagerie, actually, as soon as you mentioned that.
Oh, thank you. And boxing.
It's my favorite play.
Like, oh, is it really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do that, but probably not in a boxing match.
So with your other projects, Queen of the Lot, what's happening with that?
We're being released November 19th, and
okay.
I'm really, really looking forward to Queen of the Lot. Noah Wiley plays the leading man, my co-star in it, along with a great cast of characters, you know, because Henry always just has these amazing actors who he kind of picks and chooses from his stable and puts them into the game. And it's a beautiful cast. Catherine Crosby's in it, the late Bing Crosby's wife. She's
mm-hmm.
brilliant. Mary Crosby has a wonderful body of work and shot J.R. course.
Right,
Christopher from Breaking Away, Peter Bogdanovich, Chris Rydell. All these wonderful, really, really great cast. And it's a sequel of sorts to Hollywood Dreams, the first film that I did with Henry.
Right.
And my character, Margie Cheezik, has now become an action star and had to change her name to Maggie Chase. She's done these Red Wrecker films.
Mm-hmm.
And she is under house arrest for getting two DUIs consecutively. So she's dealing with that, and it's just another great, Hollywood parody. But I really love it. It's my favorite film that I've done with Henry so far, and I think Noah's work in it. Henry really does a beautiful job with Noah in the film, because he really is like a Henry Fonda cross with Jimmy Stewart. He's just got this leading man, this 40s leading man quality that's so engaging and lovely and so rare. And I had a great time working with him. I mean, we were it was like a, like that cliche, it was like a great tennis match. We just kept, hitting the ball back and forth to each other. And it was like very Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy-esque, if I could, I mean, I would never compare myself to those greats, but that's, if I could imagine, it was like something. So I look forward to you guys seeing that, because it's definitely my favorite film so far.
I'd really like to see it. Irene in Time was fantastic, and so I can't wait to see Queen of the Lot. But there's another movie. There's another movie that you brought up last time you were on, and I have to handle this very sensitively. It's something about I don't know the title of it, but it's something dealing with the word pucker.
Yeah.
Or.
Okay. Yes. It's that's Katie Q,
mm-hmm.
and that is still in. We actually have about a third of that left to film, because it is such a delicate and sensitive matter, and it's this horror film about. It's a horror film about the female version of Extends. I don't know if right.
Oh
so
my
it's
God.
Actually, yeah. So it has to be done very just right in order to.
I would assume that's a hard movie to make.
Thank you, Jamie. Thank you so much for the obvious use of that word there. Oh, no, I actually know the actress who does the Brigetta Tomasino, I think. She worked on a Friends of Mine film, and she's the Extends, the Extends poster girl. So, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
What is a woman? Why do they have a woman as the poster girl?
I have no idea.
That's what you can get when you take Extends.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, I mean.
Surprise.
She was also on an episode of Californication, I think, but don't quote me on that.
Well, that figures. Tana, would you like, before we let you go.
Oh, my God, you're going to do it. I can't.
We can have fun with Tana. I love this. Would you like to play a quick round of movie trivia between you and Jerry?
Yes, but...
Okay.
Oh, you guys.
Are you good at movie trivia?
I suck, too. You should have seen me last night.
Okay, good. If you suck and I suck, what do we
I'm
win?
Wretched. I'm wretched.
Oh, man, I'm so sorry. I'm all out of prizes. I'm sorry.
No, he has to get me the... They're in the gas stations now. You have to send me one of the... Female Extends, and if I win, and then I'll send you male Extends if you win.
Okay, this is a gas station. Okay.
It'll be really fun if we switch that around. That would be really fun.
Now there you go. That's why you guys are brilliant. Okay, yes, I'm totally game.
Okay.
All right, Tana, here's your question.
Okay.
I love playing game show hosts. Look at
this. Yeah, you do.
Okay, we'll do six total questions, so three questions each.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, Tana. Under potluck, who replaced Timothy Dalton as James Bond?
Do I just say I don't know if I don't know? Or do
you
I try
can.
To guess? I don't know.
Okay. That's the right answer.
I don't know.
Believe it or not.
Okay.
No, it's actually, it's Pierce Brosnan. Okay.
Pierce Brosnan. Okay.
Okay, Jerry, under potluck, here's your question. Who played the villain in the 80s movie Flash Gordon?
Oh, Max von Sydow.
Let me check. Yes, you're right. Okay.
Okay.
You are.
Hannah?
This is so set up. Are you showing me?
No, I'm not.
I have no way of knowing whether you guys are actually cheating right
I'm
now.
Jerry is in Maryland and I'm in Florida, so.
But the IMing each other. Okay. Okay.
No, we're not. Trust me, we're not.
I wouldn't do that.
I think something fishy is going on, but I'm
no,
I'm
trust me,
it.
Nothing. If that was the case, I'd like to think I would have won hands down last night, but I didn't.
Okay, Tana, here we go. In
okay.
which decade was The Sting released?
80s.
The
80s?
80s. Which one? 80s is your final answer? Okay.
Yeah.
It was the 70s. Jerry? Under.
You gotta say Jerry.
Unforgettables is your category. Tana thinks that we're out of our minds. It's like, what are we doing?
I love it.
Okay.
I love it. This is okay. I'm having a great time.
Okay, good. Thank God.
Jerry, here's your question. Oh, that's too easy. I can't give that to you.
You can't give that to me. Don't even.
Okay, here we go. Whose only Oscar nomination was for Running on Empty before his early death?
Oh, that's too easy. River Phoenix.
Okay.
That's too
okay.
Easy.
You want me? Okay.
Give me a harder one. That's not fair to Tana. Really, that's just not
yeah,
fair.
Okay. Yeah, you guys really are cheating more now than ever.
No, I'm not. All right. That's not fair. That's not fair
okay.
to you.
All right, Jerry, here's a more difficult one. I'm sorry. Who was originally billed as Oklahoma's yodeling cowboy?
What?
Is that more difficult?
Well, that is a hard one. All right.
Oklahoma's, is this for him or for me?
I'm giving him a tougher one to make it more
good.
Of a
hint. Okay.
Now, would this kind of just be like Orson Welles as Paul Masson? No. no, I just had to say that. We're doing imitations of that on Saturday. No.
Oh,
it wasn't Gene Autry. There's no way it was Gene Autry. So I don't know. I honestly have no idea.
But you'll say Gene Autry?
Yeah, I'll say Gene Autry for the hell of
it. I want to guess too. I'm going to take a guess.
Okay, please.
Okay,
can I do
go
that?
Ahead, Tana.
Can I make
yeah,
up
go ahead.
New rules? Peter Bogdanovich.
Is he a big yodeler? I didn't know that.
Well, and he does a really mean Dean Martin, so maybe he could yodel. He sounds like Dean Martin when he sings.
Oh wow!
But
okay.
It is Gene Autry, believe it or not.
Wow,
Jerry,
really?
Jerry got it right. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
You got to miss one here, Jerry.
Well, look how honest I was about the River Phoenix
yep.
thing. I'm...
Okay, Tana, do you like horror movies?
No, but
okay,
ask me anyway. I've decided
you like Gladiator movies?
So bad. I'm Gladiator movies?
I'm sorry.
That's a line from Airplane.
Airplane.
All right.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay, Tana, here's your question. Who was the female star of Rosemary's Baby?
Oh, that's easy. Why am I blanking on her name? Hold on. Woody Allen, love her. Very skinny, big eyes, weird performance.
Mm-hmm.
What? Why can't I think of her name right now? Okay. You know,
give it to her just so that all the
give me the initials sounds like
MF.
No, I can't do this. This is too much pressure. I'm like having a nervous breakdown right now.
It is Mia Farrow.
Mia Farrow. Okay, thank you.
Yes,
Mia
I'll give that to you.
No, you can't. Okay. No, that's just too pathetic. That's too pathetic. It's okay. You don't have to give it to me. It's okay.
All right, Jerry, last question for
you. Okay.
Who said Universal signed me as a contract player, which is a little lower than working in the mailroom?
Hmm. That's funny. That's a great line. Robert Mitchum? Okay, thanks, Mel. Thank you, Mel.
Mel said no. It is, what is the, oh, Clint Eastwood.
Wow. That's a great line. That's just such an awesome line.
That is such a great line.
Okay, you want to go out on one last question, Tana?
Yeah, we got to, yeah, man.
Yeah, I might as well just blow it completely.
No, you're not.
No, let's get you on the board here. Hang on.
Okay, okay.
This is under blockbusters, the category of blockbusters.
Okay.
Who played Dan Gallagher in Fatal Attraction?
He worked with Zach Norman. I should know all these names, but you failure.
No. Fatal Attraction, the lead in Fatal Attraction.
But I haven't actually seen Fatal Attraction. I know that's bad, but there's a lot of films that I have seen, so it doesn't have to be
It's not a race. It's not a thing. You don't have to
I feel like a loser right now.
No, God, no, don't say that.
Oh, my gosh,
Michael
I'm so sorry.
Douglas, right?
You're right!
Douglas, for the love of God!
You did it! Well, this was...
validated. God, I'm sweating like a pig. This is awful.
I'm so sorry I did that to you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I feel awful.
No, it was really... got my adrenaline going, and you guys always, know how to have a good time.
Well, I hope you had a pleasant time talking to us today.
We had a great time talking to you.
I had a wonderful time, and thank you for helping me out with the Michael Douglas question. And you guys, thanks for having me on the show.
All right, that's Tana Frederick.
Mm-hmm.
Another great, fun interview with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's welcome back on anytime. She's a lot of fun. You can read more about her at TanaFrederick.com. That's T-A-N-N-A. And then Frederick. I'll assume that everyone knows how to spell that.
Never assume anything.
I know. That's F-R-E-D-E-R-I-C-K period C-O-M. That's her website. So check it out. All right, so join us on Sunday night where we will not be playing movie trivia with Robert Duvall.
Thank God for that. Oh, God.
Who directed The Godfather, Mr. Duvall?
Your mother.
that's probably what he'd tell me. We're going to close the show tonight with the world internet premiere, dun-dun-dun, of the new score by Michael Wandmacher, and he actually has been a guest on the show.
Yes, he has, yeah.
And the score is from the upcoming release, Piranha 3D.
Mm.
And a guy asked in the chat room if he needs to wear glasses on his ears to fully appreciate the score.
He needs to wear his...